This is the American Digital Banking Podcast hosted by CPQI. CPQI are the leading providers of digital transformation for the financial markets in the Americas. With a focus on predictive artificial intelligence, DevOps, and cloud migration, we provide managed services including building, implementing, and supporting financial market systems. I'm your host, Deborah Boyland, and today we're joined by Tristan Pelu. Tristan is the founder and chief pencil officer at FinTech Review, director at management consulting firm Strategy Y, and a strategic advisor to several companies, including Mentor in Houston, Texas. Mentor's platform provides the best quality resources and top services to the unbanked and underbanked in the US. Within their four pillars, they provide a checking account, pocket account, loans, and education. They don't just want to give users the tools, but they also want to teach them how to use them to receive the best results. Hi, Tristan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Deborah.
For the audience, could you give us a quick rundown of who you are and how Mentor is helping consumers?
Sure. So I've worked in financial services for a few years now. I'm not that old, but I've been working in financial services for almost 10 years now. So mainly in France, the UK, Middle East. So I've seen the changes, you know, how fintech appeared, like a lot of innovation in financial services the past few years. After a few years in corporate strategy, I became a strategic advisor to several companies, including Mentor in the US. And with Mentor, we really started from scratch. Is that I worked with the founders when they had the embryo of an idea, and then we tried to make this happen. And we're going to launch soon, but we took our time to really define the value proposition, the market we wanted to tackle, and how we were going to do it. So obviously, unbanked and underbanked in the US is a big problem. So people that don't have a credit score or have a bad credit score, and so therefore they have access to a limited amount of financial services or financial services, but at a huge cost. So the founders were quite keen to tackle this issue. And I was also quite keen to help them doing that, because I believe a lot in financial inclusion, so that fintech can deliver better financial inclusion. Because the point is, it's supposed to change financial services for the better. So where banks have failed, fintech must do better.
So you mentioned people who don't have a bank account or credit score. Could you expand a bit on what defines a consumer as unbanked or underbanked?
So, unbanked is literally someone that doesn't have a bank account, like a regular bank account. In the US, according to some estimates, it could be like 10% of the population. So you're talking about like a big number, talking about like more than 30 million people with an actual like normal bank account. And underbanked is obviously an even bigger category. It's by some estimates, it could be like 100 million Americans. And the thing is, it's people who have a bad credit score. So obviously, if you're unbanked, you're likely to have no credit score at all. And if you're underbanked, is that you're gonna have a bad credit score because you're constantly making the wrong choices for many reasons. And then the thing is, you're in this kind of spiral where you don't have a good credit score, so you have access to like crap financial products, which doesn't improve your financial condition. And then, you know, you're in this circle of death. So it's a big category of the people. And the thing is, a credit score is super important in the US, because this is what defines, the kind of financial products that you access, the kind of credit card, the kind of mortgages. And so if you don't have a good credit score, then you're gonna have credit cards with super high interest rates, or like you're going to have a bad interest rate on your mortgage, or you're not going to have a mortgage at all. So it's really important. And so that's why we're so much focused on trying to help people improve their credit score.
10% is way more than I thought it was going to be. I thought you might say something like 1 or 2%. That's a lot of people, isn't it? How does Mentor's platform work exactly, and how was it developed?
So we've partnered with a banking as a service provider called Agora. So they're providing us the link basically between our app and the banking sponsor, and so they aggregate a lot of services that we've chosen to take for Menta. So Menta is an app first business. So you download the app and then you can make all the application for the credit builder loan. So what I haven't said as well is that, as I said, we're focused on improving credit score, and at its core, our main product is a credit builder loan. So, which is a product that has been developed to improve credit score. So it's for people that don't have any credit score or want to improve their credit score from a very low start to something better. And so the point is that you take a credit builder loan for a certain period of time, and then after that, you can access much better financial products. So this is at the core of our proposition, because we're like, okay, we want to help unbanked and underbanked to go from, okay, my situation isn't great, but we're coming with you. So at its core, you're going to have a credit builder loan. So you're going to improve your credit score. We're also quite strong on financial education, so explaining why credit score is important, and really helping people go from zero to hero, so yeah, from a technology perspective, it's been a lot developed by Agora and by our own team, and we plan to constantly improve that and add new products going forward.
You mentioned poor interest rates. What are the kind of biggest challenges that your target market face?
I mean, you could even call this predatory kind of interest rates. That the thing is, when you have a good credit score, basically you have access to everything, every single financial products, and you can choose the best ones. So lower interest rates, like the credit cards that give you points to go on airplanes and whatever. When your credit score is not great, basically you have access to a limited number of financial products, if any. And these are the ones with like super high interest rates, and the thing is, you choose whether or not you want to take it. But for instance, if you're like, oh, I really want a credit card, but you have a poor credit score, you're gonna have to choose between a few. And this few, the thing is, because if your credit score is low, it means the provider assumes that you have more risk of not paying. So that's why the interest rate is higher. And so this is the logic. The thing is, sometimes it's not logic, because a credit score it takes into account like many different parameters, and it doesn't mean that you're not able to pay. It just means that maybe your circumstances have meant that you have a bad credit score. But as I said, it's hard to get out of this loop, because you're going to end up paying more for whatever you're using. I mean, I'm saying, you know, double or triple the interest rates when it comes to credit cards. So this is a lot of money at the end of the year that you're not investing, you're not saving. So if you don't break this, then, you know, like we're talking about generational wealth and building wealth. The thing is, this is money you're not investing for your future. So this is where we really want to focus.
I remember growing up in England, I don't know if these are a thing anymore, but there used to be these things when I was about 12 where you would text a phone number to get like this game or even just a ringtone, and it would say £3, and then in this really tiny fine print that no 12-year-old's ever going to read, It would say, you know, £3 times the 100 times that we're going to text you. So really, it's like 300 or £3,000. And I actually know people whose mums ended up getting like really badly in debt from just these really like, yeah, predatory companies completely screwing them over. How do you think digital banking transformation has changed the market recently?
I think that customer expectations have changed massively. I mean, especially I would say the period between 2015 and now, because you have lots of consumer fintechs that have come to the market, have improved massively the way you're doing banking. And this pushed incumbent banks to actually transform and do better, because they were like, okay, well, we're going to lose all our customers if we don't have a better customer experience. So overall, it's been a huge push for more straightforward financial services, easier transfers, easier access to your banking accounts without having to go to a branch, and now you have a mobile app and all that. So it's been a big push so far. More efficient, more digital banking services, and it's continuing because it's been a lot retail focused, and now we see much more like business focused and because it's more complex. So that's why fintechs focused on retail, and so banks have kind of answered by leveling up on retail, and business needs are a bit more complex. But now we're seeing like a much more innovation in that space. So I think it's been great for the industry that had been a laggard in terms of innovation and digital transformation, just because the push wasn't there. And when you have comfy incumbents, the thing is, if you don't have a new entrant that kind of pushes them to innovate, they're gonna be like, okay, it's fine, I'm taking my profit from my customers, and I'm not reinvesting anything. So now this has changed, and it's actually great.
How do you feel digital the transformation has impacted the user experience that your platform delivers?
It all started with the advent of smartphones, and then mobile apps started to flourish, and better mobile apps. So now, you know, having a decent mobile app is just a requirement. Like you can't launch a business and say, well, look, I don't have launch a banking business and say, I don't have a mobile app. It's just normal. And so also like the fact that you have more and more APIs and connections between different services are seamless. So you can really have a customer just in one app going from one service to another and back, and this without having to, you know, go out, log in and stuff. So it's really great that APIs have been developed and platforms like Agora with that kind of gather a lot of services. So it makes it easier to make all these connections. I think this is from a user experience point of view, this is fantastic. I mean, I was talking about this yesterday, actually, like the fact that, you know, I remember when you had to, if you wanted to do something, then you're in one app and then you had to connect to another thing to make like a transfer or use another services. And you're like, yeah, okay, well, no, I want to be somewhere, and you need the less friction. So you need to be, okay, I'm here in my banking app. I want to make a transfer. I want to do like whatever. I want to access whatever service. It needs to be in the same thing. It can't be like, you can't be asking a customer to go and log in somewhere else and stuff. So I think this is the bar for user experience right now is quite high. And I think it's only getting a bit higher every time. Absolute seamless experience, and you don't want to have any and less steps as possible. Well, so that's also like a very simple user journey.
You mentioned that you guys offer both education and tools. What's the typical journey that your unbanked or underbanked consumers go through as they join your platform?
So we're, as I said, we're really trying to take them on a journey. So saying, look, we're really here for you to improve your financial situation, which means that there is a, like, first going through the basics of, as I said, the basics of personal finance, basically, like going back to, okay, you know, this is how it works. This is, you know, like stuff as basic as, you know, try to save a bit of money, try not to spend more than you earn. This is why a credit score is important. So going through the basics and iterating from there and adding a bit more complexity to personal finance education. So as in parallel to actually delivering the financial service and being on this journey with a loan, we're doing all this work of financial education and bringing people. Our goal really is to have people that join us with being underbanked or unbanked all the way to actually have a normal financial situation. And at that point, we want to add more products so that they stay with us. And we're like, okay, you were with us for all this journey of improvement. Now we have normal financial products for you. And so it's really taking people to on this improvement journey.
Would you say that the war for talent has affected your business at all?
Not really, because we're a distributed team. So some people in Houston, Texas. I'm obviously not. I'm in Barcelona, Spain. We have some of our tech team in Asia. So I think obviously, like, the war of talent is a true thing, but it's gonna be a big thing for your business if you're trying to recruit in one of these main hubs, or you're really adamant that, okay, I need everybody in San Francisco, and where it's the most expensive place ever. So obviously this is gonna be an issue. If you're a bit more open to, okay, well, you know, I'm fine having teams in various places. I see the value, like, from stress on salaries point of view. And as long as I mean, our perspective is, as long as we get the right people with the right skills that can bring value to the business, you know, and obviously we're more or less on the same time zone, it's fine. So you need to compromise. If you don't want to compromise, then you need to accept that it's going to cost you a lot to hire people in certain places.
So we've recently started seeing a bit of a slowdown across some of the big fintechs of hiring. And we've also seen some mass layoffs and a lot of job offers being pulled. Do you think these companies are acting too quickly? What are your kind of thoughts on this?
I think that investor expectations have changed massively in the past, I would say, 6 months. And with that, a lot of companies have to adapt. I think what it shows is that a lot of these companies didn't have a robust business model, in the sense that they scaled very fast, and it's this whole thing of you scale because you hope that your revenues are going to grow, and your revenues don't grow. But you, for me, I think it's a good thing for the industry as a whole, because what it means is that only, like, more serious business models are going to prevail. But if you're a company that offers everything for free because you just want to acquire users, great. But for us, for instance, we're thinking about we're probably not a typical startup in the sense that we're saying about profitability and delivering a great a great service, but thinking about doing it in a sustainable way, the sense that we don't want to offer a lot of things for free and then in 6 months pull the rug and say, look, actually, you have to pay now. So we're taking an approach that is much more sustainable, because we want to build a business that will last and that provide good service, but not lying to customers that you can offer something, but in the end, either it's not good for them. You see Robin Hood business model. Either it's not good for them, or eventually you know that you're going to pull the plug, and you're going to change your terms and conditions or stuff like that. And this is not something we want to do.
What role would you say resource augmentation providers play at your company and in your department?
I think it's from the beginning we were conscious that we needed to rely on trusted partners and have better expertise in some topics, or I mean experience or the infrastructure that you don't have. So I mean having everything in house is great. You have more control, but obviously when you get started, it's good to rely on partners out of the resources, because it's cheaper, and also you don't have the exact you don't know exactly if the resources are going to be needed. So as we go, we're obviously growing the team, and but we do it in a way that also, as I said, like careful, in the sense that if you rely on resource partners and you see that you're not scaling as fast as you can, you know, take a step back. If you hire a bunch of people and then your fixed costs are shooting up, and also there is all the thing of like building processes, it's not as easy as saying, oh, I'm going to hire like a bunch of people. Okay, yeah. Think about the processes, how you manage your teams and all that, and how do you build expertise, how do you keep expertise, how do you document all that. So we've been relying on partners, we'll continue relying on different partners, and I think for us it's the right way, and I think many companies think the same as us.
Where do you think digital banking is heading in the next year? What kind of changes do you see coming our way?
So, I mean, as you were saying, I think we'll see a bit more rationality and around some businesses will restructure, rethink a bit their business model, their value proposition, because it's not sustainable, profitable, whatever you want. So I think we'll see quite some shifts in the industry in that sense. Innovation will continue to come through. The ones that are actually, they know what they're doing and they have like more well thought business models will continue to grow and will acquire customers, but we'll see more layoffs, more restructuring, probably acquisitions of some fintech players by larger banks. It's probable that this is the environment that we're going into.
Are there any particular tools or technologies that you think will make a big impact over the coming year?
I think that, it's already a trend, but more embedded finance. So as I was saying, like, you know, having a seamless user experience, embedded finance is already here, but it's going to be more and more the expectation. So I guess it's in fintech and outside fintech, but now people don't want to have the financial journey separated from the actual purchase journey. So this is going to be a continuous trend. We'll see where crypto goes from all this recent movements, but it's also going to be good for an industry that was a bit, or part of the industry that was a bit going nuts. So I think a bit more, this is something that we'll be looking at. keeping an eye on. And yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, artificial intelligence has been around for quite some time. We're still not seeing a, I mean, we see automation, but not a lot of artificial intelligence. So trying to see if there are some decent use cases or people using it at scale, but it's not the case for now.
Does regulation have a role to play in helping the underbanked and unbanked?
It definitely does. I think, in the UK, there's been several laws around capping interest rates and stuff like that to make sure that providers don't have free lunch. I think in the US, for instance, if you look at upcoming regulations when it comes to crypto, the point is to protect consumers, and we're talking about maybe more regulation around buy now pay later. So I do think that regulation, especially in financial services, which is heavily regulated, I think it is here for a reason, is that otherwise you're going to, I mean, we've seen it in the crypto industry, not regulated, and then it went, berserk in terms of some products that were completely inappropriate and like literal Ponzi schemes. And there was expectation that it would be different, and then, we're all friends, we're all like a good community, but the reality is that if there is some money to be made, you're going to have some people with bad intentions and coming in and doing the exact same things that they could have done in the normal financial sector if there was no regulation. So, we'll see similar regulation in the crypto industry as in normal financial services, because it's obvious why. Obviously, people in there don't want it, but it's coming.
So you've mentioned crypto and embedded finance. What role, if any, do you see open banking and crypto playing in the future of Menta?
So I think open banking and embedded finance, I could definitely see how this could be in our future, in the sense that enabling. Because after retail, we're thinking about businesses, and some businesses that face the same kind of issues, accessing normal finance and accessing like kind of developing their businesses. So I think that definitely providing the right tools for businesses to grow, which could include embedding our financial solutions in businesses. Crypto, we don't see it now. We don't see this as part of our future, and not even partnering, because we believe that there are like so many things that people should be doing before trading crypto in terms of improving their personal finances, if there are 100 things to do before that, I think for us, we'll do it before looking at offering like crypto trading or partnering with crypto providers.
Last question before we let you go. Do you have any advice for anyone who would like to start building a career in digital banking?
Read a lot of stuff. There are lots of resources and news media articles. I mean, you can literally spend 20 hours a day reading stuff about fintech, like whether analysis or news or fintech, digital innovation in banking. So I think that the first thing is to read a lot, to make up your own mind about what's going on, what are the trends, trying to grasp what's going on. I think it's super important before you step in into a career and you want to work in a sector, you really need to understand what's going on. Whatever your job is, because the thing is, even if your job is you're a developer, you want to know which company to go work for, why, you know, what do they stand for, what financial product they're providing. Are they providing something that is actually useful for people and helping them? Or are you okay working for companies that actually is, you know, offering predatory loans or like, you know, screwing people up? So, but you need to understand what's going on in the industry. So my first advice is to read a lot, seeing who, because then you will understand who are the companies that are winning, who do you want to work for, what do they stand for in terms of, you know, value proposition, and what do you find interesting. That's I think a good first start that takes a bit of time, and then just jump into it.
Thanks so much for joining us, Tristan.
Thanks.
This was the American Digital Banking Podcast, hosted by CPQI. Don't forget to follow us to hear more.